Maine. So if you're looking for something to do one weekend, check out a town that's within driving distance and just walk the streets. Not just the main street, but the residential areas. You not only see creative landscaping and decor, but if people are out front watering their yard or working in it, you can have some interesting conversations. There was this one gentleman who was working in his front yard, digging it out. Turns out he had accidentally cut into his sprinkler system. His garage door was open, and there's beautiful, bright yellow 1956 Chevy. Now, I knew it was a 56 Chevy because there was a sign out front that said, 1956 Chevy. He happily showed it to us because he used to participate in classic car shows, and he opened the hood, and it was chromed out. Seriously, chromed out. Yes, the engine. He said, in fact, he had received best chrome at one show. So get out and explore. Just casual, laid-back day. It's the best. The adage, give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. It's not just a cliche, as Heifer International has demonstrated for decades. This year, the organization celebrates its 70th anniversary, providing livestock and environmentally sound agricultural training to improve the lives of those struggling for reliable sources of food and income. In the early days of the organization, heifers were the best choice as they could not only provide milk, but also a calf to pass on the gift. Today, heifers are not the only animals donated to assist communities. There are also sheep, llamas, alpaca, rabbits, water buffalo, honeybees, goats, ducks, geese, and camels. I sat down with John Brewer and Cheryl McKinney about Heifer International's history and the domino effect the organization has produced for consecutive generations of global communities.
My name is Cheryl McKinney, and I first became involved as an active volunteer with Heifer in late 2009.
I'm John Brewer, and I became involved in 2004.
And how did you each get pulled into it? What flagged your attention?
Well, one Christmas, our music teacher, I was assistant superintendent in the school district, came in and says to me, do you want to buy a llama? And I said, I'm already donating to Loaves and Fishes and different things, you know. And she said, keep this in your drawer. That's a brochure. And a year or two later, the teacher who ran our community day school, which was composed of kids that had actually been kicked out of school, but we were still responsible for educating them, wanted a project for her kids so they could be seen for something positive versus, you know, always for the trouble that they caused. And so through working with her, we realized that kids love animals. We realized that on the Heifer website, there are many educational materials, and that I retrieved that little brochure and I said, what if we get these kids involved in some fundraising and some activities around Heifer International?
Nice.
Yeah.
A friend and I were talking about world population issues and just noticing that there are many more people on the earth than really the earth can be expected to support long term. And so we challenged each other to just find a group that's doing something in that realm. So I looked around, I did a lot of research, and I started with population-focused nonprofits. And then I came upon a research finding that says that families who have a security in their food supply and a security that their life is stable and protected, communities with families like that, the birth rate will spontaneously decrease. So then I looked much more widely at groups, and when I came upon the Heifer website, I remembered, oh, I have contributed to Heifer in churches that I've been in before. Let me look at them again. Then I found that at that time, Heifer had a regional office here in Sacramento. So all those three things conspired to make me reach out and get actively involved.
So I understand, or this is the 70th anniversary of Heifer. How did you celebrate locally?
You know, our volunteer group is composed of a lot of people, but I'd say 12 really active people. And we put our heads together back over the last winter and decided, hey, let's do something really interactive. Maybe let's kind of coordinate it with something called World Food Day. And then later found out it's also International 2014, the International Year of Family Farmer. So all those themes, we were kind of brainstorming around that idea. And since it was the, you know, celebration of 70 years of existence of the organization, we thought it might be nice to talk about heifer past, heifer present, and heifer future. And that was really significant for us because in just the summer before, we visited Ecuador. So we really saw heifer present in action by visiting several projects there in Ecuador. And that's how we kind of pieced it together. But we didn't want it to be just sitting and listening. We really wanted it to be interactive. And so we put our heads together and came up with, I think there were 12 choices that a participant or someone who attended could choose from in the first hour and a half or hour and 45 minutes. So they could walk into this room with all of these things that they, you know, there's an art activity, there was a music activity, there were live chicks with this whole beautiful educational experience of the value of chickens, you know, across the planet. There was a cookie decorating. And I'm telling you, some art got done that day on those cookies. I'm serious. Got some pictures of those. Several, we had the big spinning wheel where you would land on one of Heifer's 12 cornerstones and be asked a question and have a chance to win a prize. And a beautiful activity called What's for Dinner that you might draw one of four different possibilities of what a person in a given region of the world might be having or not for dinner that day. So we tried to make it things that were intriguing, interesting, fun, but also that generated some learning.
Well, it's nice you had a dozen options.
Yeah.
Really put some effort and time into it, and I'm sure that showed everybody who visited it.
Right. And we had food, and, you know, it was really, really good. We had had a high school, a Grant High School in town has a great program. It's an environmental design program for college prep kids, and they have a garden that I didn't even know about, and it's a beautiful garden. I went over to talk to those students and their teacher, and they got involved. They came out and set up a table, and I was wondering if they would help me on the next thing, which was I wanted some people to dress up in farm animal costumes.
It's a celebration.
Yeah, teenagers, you know, they're going to be too shy or something. And these two of these kids dressed up as farm animals, and my good buddy Kirk also, who's an adult, dressed up. Go bow.
Oh, no, you can't let that go. What animals? You have to tell me the animals.
Right. We had a pig.
Okay.
Which I was going, is anybody going to get in that costume? But they did. And we had a cow, luckily, Heifer International. And Kirk, my friend, was a chicken.
A man-sized chicken,
yes. And the idea was go and interact with people and see if people would want to take cell phone shots with their cell phone and maybe do on-the-spot sharing on Facebook or what have you, Twitter. A lot of pictures got snapped and a lot of fun was had with those roving band, the little farm animals.
I can just imagine Twitter must have been pretty busy that day.
I hope so. Yeah, so we want to get the word and the celebration out. And the balancing part was we did have presentations and speakers, but one of the heart of what we were doing too was to honor churches and various organizations who have been big heifer supporters over the years. So we had, I think, 13 different churches. Actually, 68 churches were invited, but 13 had really done so much over the years that we did a special honoring. And then we had, I don't know, 8 or 10 organizations like the Girl Scouts and
Kiwanis
Club and others that we honored as well. It was great because we not only, you know, did presentations with frame certificates and all, we took photos of every group that was there so they could then publish it in their newsletter back in their church or organization. And I don't know, it's just really, really celebration.
It's a very synergistic celebration.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I learned that Jan West Schrock, who is the sister of the person who got the initial idea for Heifer, she told me that maybe 30 years ago, a group of church ladies visited Heifer headquarters in Little Rock, Arkansas, and they really were very taken with the mission of Heifer. So they came back to Sacramento and they sowed the seed in almost every church in Sacramento.
Nice.
That's probably a reason why we had a regional office here. And so the people that were at our 70th anniversary celebration were from congregations that early on they were on board, and they have been an important part of the Hever support over the years. So when so many people stood up in the room, I just got a tremendous sense of Hever past, very deep roots and very deep commitment for a very deep cause, and then going into present and future. So our celebration really meant a lot of things. It was worth all that, all those months of work.
Yeah.
Well, and plus you're bringing the kids into it, so you're planting a mental mm-hmm. seed with them to mm-hmm. be open and looking for organizations such as Hever, mm-hmm. which is fabulous.
That's right.
Our first project was in 1944. So 70 years, that sounds like a long time. 1944. I can relate to that as a long time ago. That was just 4 years before I was born. Long time ago. 17 pregnant heifers on a boat to a village in Puerto Rico. That was the first project.
So Hever originated then, but it was during the war, World War II.
And actually, even before that.
The seed of the idea occurred before that. A Midwestern farmer, Dan West, accompanied his church group, Church of the Brethren, to Europe. It was refugees of the Spanish Civil War, and they were handing out food aid. And as a farmer, he was just struck with the unworkability of food aid. Long line of women and children waiting for milk powder. He said, this is completely inadequate. What these people need is a cow. So there was the genesis of the idea.
Not a cup, but a cow.
Not a cup, but a cow.
The very first little
sound bites,
slogans, yeah.
Mottos, if you will.
And his heart was touched so much because they really, literally, they had limited resources and they had to make some life and death decisions about who would actually receive, you know, the food stuff that they had, including the milk. And those who were kind of already sort of, quote unquote, too far gone might not even receive it. So his heart was broken and then broken open to come back to the States and to the Midwest and connect with families of farmers and convene them and try to work towards a real life solution using livestock was their next steps. And one of those people was Bill Beck, who was a 88-year-old former Methodist minister who was one of those original, they called them the seagoing cowboys, because at that point they were not only raising the animals, but it was totally hands-on. They actually got on the boat with the animals and transported them and delivered them to those who would receive them. The main agreement in offering those animals was, we would like you to pass on this gift that we're giving you. And so that's a fundamental cornerstone for Hever, is passing on the gift, meaning that when the animals have their first female offspring, those animals are passed on to others in the community or the village. And along with the passing on of the animals themselves is that one of the tenets of Hever too is training and education. So that before you ever receive animals, you receive training and a lot of education is set up, the infrastructure, so that when you pass on the offspring, you also provide the mentoring, coaching, and training for the next set of families that receive that next generation of animals. So you become, in the space of a year or two, somebody who's receiving to somebody who's giving, somebody who is basically donating. That's a cycle of passing on the gift that I think a lot of people, including myself, really draws people to the organization, because it's a model of empowerment.
Self-sustainability.
Yeah.
The opposite of dependency. There's been a lot of press and debate in the last few years about relief and aid organizations creating dependency. That's the last thing an aid organization really wants to do.
You don't want to just supply a Band-Aid. You want to supply the entire first aid kit and the kitchen and the dining room table. And I was a volunteer youth crisis counselor 7 years ago for Interface in Ventura County. And they initially were providing counseling for kids that were on drugs and drinking too much. And it became painfully obvious that it was an extension of problems at home.
Oh, yes.
So they started expanding their program. And that's my impression is what Hever has been doing. What we think now is an obvious realization that you can't just, here's a chicken, and just expect them to be fed for the next 20, 30 years. It just doesn't work that way.
Right.
All animals are mortal, and you have to get the next generations in line to continue the cycle, as you say.
Yeah, there's a metaphor or an image that I really like, and it's, well, there's the classic one to begin with, you know, which is give a family or a person a fish they'll eat that night, teach a person or a family to fish, and then they can eat on into the future. But what Heifer's about is teaching people how to make fishing poles.
There you go.
It goes a step further than that, because, you know, food security is one thing, and another is income development, so that individual families and villages can use those resources, those assets. Those farm animals are assets, not only for food security, but income development. So it is a small business model in a way of thinking as well.
It's beyond subsistence. It's connecting communities to markets, helping them build markets. It's very, possibly the first projects in the beginning years were on a subsistence level.
Right.
But as the organization developed and its mission developed, as the world developed too, things became, they went further.
Well, speaking as the world developed, so from 1944 till 2014, communication obviously has altered over the years. Mm-hmm. So that must have assisted in communicating with other countries and how you could help overseas or north or southern parts of the continent.
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, in the first years of Heifer's activity, of course, the first project was before the war ended, but I'd like to think of it as a kind of civil society arm of the Marshall Plan. I recently read that troop ships that weren't being used anymore, troop transport ships, were the first ones used to transport animals that had been donated and raised by farmers in the U.S., collected at collection sites, taken to a port, then loaded on a ship. Troop transport ships were used. Haven't seen statistics, but I think if you can remember the destruction of the war, both in Europe and Asia, it wasn't only people that were destroyed in buildings, it was animals. Mm-hmm. Farm animals were either killed, starved, eaten. So as a civil society addition to the Marshall Plan, the animal and farm culture was built back up, both in Europe and Asia. And there was a time in the 50s in South Korea, mid-50s, it was said that half of all the chickens in South Korea could trace their lineage back to a heifer-supplied flock.
Take course, that, Ancestry.com.
Yeah.
Of course, South Korea now, heifer does not work in South Korea because South Korea has, you know, gone beyond what heifer needs. It's a prosperous, prosperous nation. But right after the war, that was a very good place to work.
And looking at history and, you know, that model of delivering the animals, and you had talked about how things changed over time. And right now what Heifer does is form relationships and partnerships with farms all over the world who are involved with animal husbandry, so that the animals now are raised locally. Can you imagine a cow from Santa Rosa being transported to South India and, you know, be able to adapt to that climate and the various diseases and pests that they would have to
adapt. Well, I did wonder about that.
Yeah.
Because in people, they say that if you ingest foods that are not indigenous to an area that you were raised, that your system doesn't always acclimate to it, or not easily. So I did naturally wonder if that same applied with animals.
Yeah, and so we form business relationships, I could say, and this is part of Heifer's beauty to me is that, yes, we do have the international office here in Arkansas, in Little Rock, but all across the world, you know, in the various projects, be they the regional offices, onto the local offices, and to the farms I was just talking about, they're all indigenous people, local people that are running them. What Heifer also does is really work to have high standards, you know, high quality standards for the gene stock, if you will, regarding these animals, so that they are high producers.
In the first decades of Heifer's existence, those high genetics animals couldn't be had close to the project countries, so that's why they came from the U.S. But now that's not the case. And I'd say also Heifer's kind of mission, or the way it's implementing its mission, has grown and gotten wider to now heifer works in communities where heifer is invited in, first of all. And a new community, it's not the first thing that's done to talk about sheep, goats, cattle, pigs, or trees. In a new community, heifer facilitators that are natives of the country in question work with the community group to say, well, you know, what is the strength of your community and what would you want to pass on to your grandchildren that continue living here? And what direction do you want your community to go? So it isn't until all that has really been worked out and discussed that then they start looking at, well, now what is the geography? What is the ecology here? What is the culture here? And of course, what are the aims of the community? So all those factors then will have to bear on what the specific project would be. So in that way, the breed of the animals that are chosen, the type of animals that are chosen, they're all going to be very appropriate for all those factors I just listed.
And ultimately, the community creates their own project from that initial visioning, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a strategic planning process based on those 12 cornerstones that we mentioned earlier. You know, and so they kind of build in their own accountability measures, too. And that's one of the things that donors are rightfully very interested in and concerned about is, what are you doing to make sure that the resources that we're donating are going to the best possible use? And when there's ownership right from the get-go by those who actually are receiving the services, or the resources, I should say, and Heifer works to keep good records, too, over the years. But that ownership at the beginning is what matters the most.
So how are donors apprised of a need, or just approached generally, would you be interested in? How does the word get out?
Especially in the first decades of Heifer, I think most of the support and interest and word getting out was within congregations. And then that's gone beyond, as congregations maybe have had a less strong role in society as a whole, as more people are unchurched, so to speak, then it's through civic groups. Heifer itself has publicity. Can you say more specifically
I think
on that?
A lot of people have really taken to is alternative gift giving.
Ah, right.
Around the holidays, for example. We have our problems here in America too. We have hunger and poverty too. But so many of us are doing so well. And, you know, I think there's a natural capacity in all humans really to want to help, to want to contribute and support, and also pass on ideas that involve compassion to the younger members of their family. So alternative, our gift-giving catalog that goes out.
And women, too, are trying in different cultures that maybe before didn't have the option of becoming empowered, now can do that. Well, I thought it was interesting in reading one of Heifer's pamphlets that women are responsible for producing up to 80% of the food.
Worldwide,
yet they only...
Correct.
Own less than 2% of the land. That's mm-hmm. craziness.
Mm-hmm. That is.
So again, I think it's fabulous that Heifer is promoting these women for owning the land,
mm-hmm.
producing their own income, in addition to producing food for their families and the community.
Right.
And gender equity is an integral part of every project. So when I say that projects have to be appropriate for the culture, the cultural norms, that is one arena where if a cultural norm does not include women, no, Heifer does not respect that cultural norm.
Nice.
That's
women
one,
have to be included.
That's one element of the change process that's a big part of what we're doing. And one way to do that is to fund projects that are women owned and operated or run. And over half of Heifer's projects are exactly that. And that's partly because the research is telling us that those resources are better used. And I'm not sure all the reasons why, but it's a model that does work. And along with gender equity is support for the family. So that if we can help to promote everybody working together and nobody being excluded from decision making and from making this work for all of us, then, you know, it's really a win-win for everyone. But it's hard. There have been difficulties letting go for the men, I think, letting go and being an equal partnership with women. But we're seeing it happen more and more.
And it's also looking down the road, if something happens to the so-called breadwinner, there's backup in place with the family because
yeah.
they've been trained and educated in addition to Ma and Pa.
Right.
On how to continue to produce the farm. So yes. I like that holistic effect, the entire family being involved.
Yeah, and there it's a community-based. The work is community-based, so each family is part of a group of families. So for that reason, it's strong.
You have strong backup. It's always good to have backup every aspect of your life.
We mentioned the 12 cornerstones. Formerly, they're known as 12 cornerstones for just and sustainable development. And these were articulated by getting the input of many, many people who are working in development to say, what are the essential parts of a project? So this was winnowed down. Two of them speak to what we just were mentioning. One is labeled gender and family focus. The other, full participation.
So I'm wondering about the schools. Are the schools sometimes part of these community projects as well to incorporate into the classroom? Or is it kept separate?
Do you mean here in the United States of supporters, or do you mean in project countries?
Well, here in the States, we are happily promoting urban farms, producing gardens in your backyard to have fresh produce. But there are schools that are also involved. We'll have patches of land on the school property with the children, like Alice Waters in Berkeley, one of the early templates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the students plant the seeds, harvest them, learn how to cook. So I'm wondering if in countries outside of the U.S., if they're doing something similar. Have you heard of anything like that?
I haven't, but I think it's a wonderful idea.
The breadth of heifer projects that there are, I wish I knew the specifics of all of them. It's going to really depend on the community, because each is individual. So I will not say that there are not schools involved.
I'm just curious if you'd heard of any. One of the lovely things about the internet is sometimes the word gets out and they try it in their little community. And and teachers that are really trying to raise their students up on a higher level and really empower them in life might decide to incorporate sometimes in one of their classroom projects. But I was just curious if
you
heard of
it. Yeah, well, I wanted to say two things. One is that one of the outcomes of getting involved with Heifer and a community becoming empowered and raising their standard of living is more kids going to school, particularly girls, who are the ones left behind often in schooling. So that is a huge focus for us. And then the other is that there's a lot of schools across the country who have got involved with learning about Heifer.
In the U.S.
In the U.S., learning about this organization and then wanting to do something for children around the world, and then doing fundraising projects to contribute to Heifer as well. That's something I'm very familiar with, having been in the school system for 4 years, now retired, but I love going into schools and working with teachers or whole schools, sometimes, or just a single class. And if it's only to just come in and share something about either Heifer or about the nature of hunger and poverty in the world, then that's fine for me. But we do have amazing resources that are available for free. We'll call Global Education Resource Kits, GERC. Okay, but those kits are brilliant. They all come with a beautiful book, a story about some region of the world, a DVD, usually about 10 or 12 minutes featuring that region of the world, and then these well-designed curriculum units that are linked to the Common Core. We won't go into that. So they're real viable resources for social studies and history and economics and those kinds of things, and can really be valuable resources for teachers.
All those are free and downloadable at heifer.org.
Yeah.
There's a book titled Beatrice's Goat. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen this book, but it really is kind of the archetypal heifer story. Beatrice is a real person. It's a real family, and it recounts that her job as a school-aged child was not to go to school. It was to help her mom and to watch her baby brother, because her family could not afford to send her to school. We're so used to in the U.S. having free public education, but in many developing countries, it's not free. There has to be the uniform bought, school fees, and then money for materials. So when Beatrice's mom, through a heifer project, got a goat, then Beatrice learned to milk the goat. The kids started drinking the goat milk, so their level of nutrition was up. Beatrice's mom used the goat manure in her garden, So there was more productivity. Then they had milk to sell. And because of that income, then Beatrice was able to afford the uniform, the school fees, and the materials, and she got to go to school. You can see me getting a little emotional about that, but that's one family story that's been replicated and replicated so many times. Of course I have to volunteer forever.
Well, tell me some of your personal stories.
I started talking a little bit about, I was assistant superintendent in a school district, and as such, you know, not as directly linked with what's happening in the classrooms, you know, and with programs. And when we started this community day school for the kids who'd been expelled, their teacher, as I said, really wanted to do something, you know, where these kids could be do something positive. And so we started by recycling. And we had like $100 in the bank, and they were going, well, what are we going to do with the money? That's where Heifer came in, made that first donation. And they got all fired up. And they were, we got to make this bigger. And the idea was, let's go over to the student councils in the other 10 schools, and let's get the other schools doing something. So basically, I invented a service learning program involving the student councils in our 10 elementary schools. And so the deal was, it'd be me and two or three of these young men who were some tough customers too. The deal was, is we're going to go talk and we're going to go ask them in on this, but you guys have to say, you have to be part of the presentation. So they came out with me and we'd make our presentation, and we got the student councils involved. And we trained the student councils to do presentations in the classrooms, and then to lead a fundraising drive. It could be a penny drive, or it could be a little talent show, or a dinner. There were all kinds of different things that were done to raise money. Over the first year, we raised, I think it was $4,000. And this is in a high-poverty district, by the way. And we had this big event at the end where we invited all 10 schools. Each one picked somebody to do a one-minute speech, usually the student council president. They invited their parents to come in, and only the teachers came. And then we did something entertaining. We had a relevant type of assembly or performance. We had the Banana Slug Band from Santa Cruz. We're awesome science teachers that are also musicians. And it was such a great, I don't know, just sort of celebrational conclusion to the year. And luckily, the superintendent and the school board loved it. And we went on for two more years and just did variations. The second year, we used world literature. And the third year, we used world music as kind of our theme. And over the course of 3 years, we raised more than $10,000 in one of the most high poverty areas in Sacramento.
Well done.
And so they said, why don't you, Mr. Brewer, come down and go on an educator study tour? So 40 educators went to Honduras. And then seeing projects firsthand was what did it for me. You know, talk about your heart breaking open to see people with a third grade education, women, standing up and giving these presentations without notes, which were just stunning, and then to see the sense of ownership and value that they had in their particular project was very inspiring. And so basically, I'm a lifer, Heifer lifer.
Heifer lifer, and it's fun to say.
Yeah, Heifer lifer, yeah.
Now, you must have met individuals as well in Honduras.
Yeah.
Did they tell you some of their personal stories and how they benefited?
Yeah, I remember, I think her name was Graciela. It's one of the people that gave this presentation, and they had a pig project. And it was eight women who represented eight different families that created this pig project. And the idea was they did want food security, but they really wanted to form like a business. And so they looked upon the pigs as living bank accounts in a way. Because a really healthy adult, you know, sow can have, I think it's 14 to 16 piglets, which were put for sale in the market, and they were able to create their own bank account. So you've heard of microloans. Well, they're actually creating their own bank account they could borrow against. And their idea was to expand to at least 20 women, representing 20 different families. And then the long-term goals, many of her projects, if not all have some sense of what do we want to see 5 to 7 years down the road. And sometimes it's a health clinic, sometimes it's a school or extending a school to grade level wise, or easier access to clean water, or more sanitary conditions, or housing. So in their case, I believe, if I'm remembering right, they wanted to have a school or add grades to their school, if I'm remembering right. But what I was really impressed by, walking around this village, I was noticing these pigs that were all sort of scrawny and ragamuffin looking, and they were like kind of digging, and they can wreck the environment. These women, they had very humane, large pens for the pigs. The pigs were bathed every single day. They were just absolutely pristine creatures. If you can think of a pig as noble, which I think of their animals as noble because of the way they were raised by these women, and comparing to when animals are, let to go feral, they can create a lot of destruction in the world and not be viable resources for food. Our keynote speaker at our event from Ecuador, the director of Heifer Ecuador, really referenced love. The farmers that work in the collaboratives that she leads really are in a relationship of deep respect for the land. And in essence, that the produce is created through love. And that's the energy that I felt from this women's collaborative that had their pig project. Because, they're really wanting to make life more wonderful, not just for themselves, but for their families, their children, into the future.
Healthier and higher quality all around.
Yeah.
As John mentioned, last summer some of our volunteer group went on a trip of a lifetime to see some heifer projects in Ecuador. And it was very special to have the country director of Heifer Ecuador be at our 70th celebration. That was great. But what we saw in Ecuador, many things had me very interested. I talked about Beatrice's goat and Beatrice's family being kind of the archetypal heifer story just within one family. Now, in Ecuador, what we saw is that the people, Ecuadorians, tend to really get the group energy thing, and there are collectives and cooperatives and nonprofits. They're highly organized among themselves. And so Heifer Ecuador then appropriately comes alongside those groups that already have organized themselves. They already have a strong mission. Heifer Ecuador comes alongside and helps them. Well, what is the next thing that you need to do? And I just said groups as a whole, but of course, heifer, really, a guiding principle is a word that we learned in Spanish, agroecología, agroecology. It's farming in concert or in harmony with ecological principles. So Heifer Ecuador will be involved with groups that have an agroecological focus. And we met various farmers from one particular cooperative that is in the Andes. It's a province a couple hours south of the capital, still in the Andes. We visited 4 different farms and talked with 4 different farmers. I was just really struck with their level of skill and care, bringing forth the plants and animals that they raise high up there in the Andes. This group had already gotten together to form Growers Co-op, and they have a market presence every Saturday morning in the capital of the province. And so growers from the co-op all contribute produce and take turns manning the stalls there. We learned that farms in the Andes can have a differentiation in altitude such that you can grow certain crops at a higher altitude that won't grow at a lower altitude on your same farm where you can grow other crops. So the range of crops that they had to offer at the market were quite wide. What Heifer did was several things, as I understand it. One, establish a seed money fund that members of the co-op then could get microloans from. Second, they helped to support and train a couple of techs who helped the farmers get and maintain organic certification in the province. So it's all organic food and meat that they're offering. Third were some animal projects around as appropriate, some flocks of chickens, and just various ones as appropriate. Mostly, heifer did not supply specific animals. As one of the staffers explained to me, the farmers here have such varying conditions in the varying altitudes and such skill that they are the ones to know best what animals and plants work. So to provide them instead with seed money is really the most direct and skillful way that we can aid in their development. Meeting the farmers was just, we were charmed. Mm-hmm. Great people, very friendly to us, and very proud of what they've done, rightfully so.
And part of the agroecology, too, that I'm recalling and really appreciating is with heifer working to support the farmers with anything we can do in terms of modern technology while deeply respecting and integrating with indigenous wisdom. So some of the things that we do with our farming more and more would be things like companion planting, so that instead of using pesticides, of course it's all organic, so I guess it's a given, but I was impressed to see they were planting certain plants that repelled pests. And in fact, they have living fences, which are various trees and bushes that do the same thing. They attract pollinators of all kinds, while at the same time, somehow, I don't know how they do it, but repel pests. And I don't know, I think the modern technology part, I'm no expert on farming, but we went to that field, one of the fields that Cheryl was talking about, and there we talk about, what's the kind of planting where you you build raised beds, or there's a name for it, I'm not remembering right now, but there was like, where the plants were being planted, there were like, I could stick my arm down into this topsoil up past my elbow. This was like the richest ground I think I'd ever seen, because they let the land go fallow, they let the land replenish itself. They plant crops that are designed to help the land to replenish itself. And I don't know what kind of tractors they used, but they were the deepest furrows I'd ever seen, and I don't know, it was like inspiring. I mean, it was like, life was just vibrating off of that land.
And the soil itself.
And the soil itself.
You were describing the soil.
Yeah.
The person that has kind of codified and introduced agroecology as a discipline is at UC Berkeley. His name is Miguel Altieri. But really, the principles of agroecology have been known over the millennia. And traditional farmers that we met in the Andes, many of those practices had been handed down to them. But now someone has a system and a code,
yeah,
and can name the science of what they are doing, so that then it's carried forward.
I remember reading, you know, that you weren't in your regular flower garden. You weren't supposed to water in circles around the plants. And my grandmother did that for 50, 60 years, and Sunset Magazine would come out and photograph her yard. So, a little difference of opinion.
Yeah.
It's probably not a problem.
It worked for her.
Obviously.
So, looking forward, what are some of the projects and ideas that are coming down the pike that have kind of piqued your interest?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I was impressed with in Ecuador was the real passion for maintaining the integrity of the seed stock, of the seeds. And I don't want to become political, but, you know, they want to, there's nothing more valuable, really, ultimately, than the food that we eat. I don't think there could be anything more valuable. So to be able to have the control over the integrity of actually what you're planting into the ground versus what some large company might want to
mass produce.
So I was impressed with that. I mean, because in Ecuador and Peru, I think there's like, thousands of varieties of potatoes. So that was one of the things, is like really respecting the gene pool in terms of the seed stock was one. I think that another one here, that we actually have heifer projects in America, you know, it's in, isn't it Alabama, Mississippi?
There's one in Appalachia, North Carolina, and the other in the Mississippi Delta region in Arkansas. And both those areas were chosen in part because there were high rates of childhood malnutrition. So it was like, let's get something going in those two communities.
Seeds of Change.
Seeds
right.
of Change.
The reference to Seeds of
is
Change.
The U.S. program.
Largely agricultural.
It is.
Right.
And aren't there seed banks as well where people are trying to set them aside because of climate change and environmental issues?
Yeah, those do exist in all over the world, I believe. Yeah.
But I'd never seen it in front of me with somebody holding a hand out with this variety of seeds. And I got the sense that they were holding something valuable like gold.
That was one of the Andean farmers we visited. He was the seed keeper for his sub-co-op in the co-op that I mentioned. And so we went in his seed storehouse where he had gunny sacks of seeds.
The seed keeper. That looked nice in your CV.
Yeah. Well, Heffner's also doing some other interesting things, too, right? Like working with a larger geographical regions is one thing. So that, you know, if you would envision it, at least metaphorically, it would be like spokes of a wheel, you know, to set up some relationships so that you have a sense of something growing, maybe from an initial set of villages out, like spokes of a wheel, out further geographically. So more long-term planning and envisioning and forming relationships. That's one. And the other thing that Heffer is doing is teaming with other like-minded organizations that have a supportive niche, if you will. And one is the East Africa Dairy Project. The first cycle was funded by the Gates Foundation 7 or 8 years ago. And so Heffer teamed with, of course, we supplied the animals and the animal husbandry and setting up the milk farms. It's a dairy project. But one of the big problems there was, how do we keep this milk cold so it doesn't spoil? So then refrigeration. There's another organization that specializes in that, refrigeration. And another one was transportation. And I think another one might have had to do with infrastructure, things like roads. So that's another, you know, we by synergizing and collaborating with other major like-minded organizations, we can have a deeper impact. And boy, East Africa Dairy Project was looked at under a microscope, you know, as far as accountability goes, and it was a rip-roaring success. It can be viewed online to get more detailed information, but it was refunded. It was so spectacularly successful that another $50 million from Gates is now being used in very beautiful ways in I think it's Tanzania, Kenya.
And as I understand it, that was really the outgrowth of the maturity of early Heffer projects, where then farmers were established with their dairies, and then they had the milk in volume to sell. So it's kind of a third generation kind of outgrowth. And yes, there's money being put in to construct the milk cooling facilities and all the public health measures around that and the quality control. So there's money going in for that, but there won't always have to be money going in because those things then will be self-sustaining.
What about the poor people that are living in the cities, the urban environments? You know, how do they...
They get to buy some of that milk.
If it's local or somewhere, it's shipped by transportation.
It can be transported within the countries.
One of the areas that was thought about when this whole project was designed or thought of was the AIDS epidemic in Africa too. Realizing that even with the antiviral, you know, medicines, without proper nutrition, it was not as likely for someone to survive AIDS, and so that was one. And supplying the AIDS orphanages, for example, with milk was another focus of that project.
Your system, when it's allowed to do its job, can actually perform quite amazing self-healing feats.
Oh, our own bodies, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the Heffer goals is what the CEO calls scaling up. Now when projects are conceived of, they need to involve 1,000 or more families per project. So there's an urgency. Like now there's a model that's worked really well over the decades. Now let's share it with an increased number of people.
This interesting organization to work as a volunteer for, Heffer, because it's not like working with or volunteering for, say, Loaves and Fishes, where you can go down maybe with some people from your organization and serve lunch to the homeless. hands-on, or Habitat for Humanity that goes and builds, which I admire both of those organizations so much. But our work as volunteers is kind of twofold, in that one is to just to share the story as a way of kind of raising consciousness and offering alternatives as a way to help in the world. For the donation of the funds, which then turns into these animals and turns into these long-term projects that, that change lives in entire communities.
The two U.S. projects, U.S.-based projects, they really both address the current situation of food insecurity that so many families in the United States now find themselves in. Mm-hmm. Calling them seeds of change, when those two projects come to fruition, Heifer then wants to have a replicatable model to go forward and partner with groups in other communities to go further. So that's the work in the U.S., which is it will be spreading and I think is really valuable. And I think it's valuable to help those right now outside our borders, because really the world is one. In so many ways we find that we're so interconnected. So the health of a community that's outside our borders, it impacts us in ways that mm-hmm. we're not really able to quantify all yeah. the time.
And I love Heifer's languaging around that too, where we reference the people that we work with as our project partners. I love that we are, you know, that there's a reciprocal exchange going on. It's not just I'm doing something to you. It's not around pity. It's around true compassion. There's something in me that gets what's going on in your life, and there's something in you that gets what's going on in my life, and how can we just form a bond, because we're human beings and we've been brought together this way. I love feeling like I'm a project partner when I visit Ecuador or Honduras.
You're just helping somebody in the family.
That's right.
There are a variety of options to assist Heifer International if you're interested in doing so, such as donating funds for acquiring a specific animal, and tree seedlings, as trees are an integral part of any small farm. They produce fruit, firewood, and fodder for livestock, and prevent erosion. You can also donate funds for a stove for a village, and irrigation pumps. Visit Heifer, that's HEIFER.org/catalog, and click on Gift Catalog to view the variety of choices. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Grant Coors Ranch National Historic Site in Deer Lodge, Montana, located between Yellowstone and Glacier National Parks. Johnny Grant originally owned the property when he was wintering cattle in western Montana valleys in the 1850s, and then Conrad Coors purchased the Grant home and 365 head of cattle in 1866. His powerful partnership with his younger half-brother, John Bielenberg, not only grazed cattle in the valley, but also expanded to other ranges in eastern Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and Canada. During the open range era, most ranchers owned a base of operations, and some, like Coors, owned millions of acres. The open range cattle industry only lasted about 3 decades, with only a few ranchers actually making their fortunes. The main obstacles originally were buffalo and Indians. Then as ranches multiplied and the northern herds grew, there was the problem of overgrazing. And in the winter of 1886 to 87, 1/3 to 1/2 of all cattle on the northern plains were lost. Many cattlemen never recovered. Open ranging pretty much reached an end with homesteaders' barbed wire and fenced-in claims. A cattle drive from Texas to Montana could take up to 5 months, as they rarely went more than 10 to 12 miles per day. After all, bovines needed to rest and graze. Do you know where the phrase, too many irons in the fire, originates? The coal fire may burn hotter than 2200 degrees, which is too hot for an iron. So, an inattentive blacksmith's work can be destroyed if there are too many irons in the fire. The Coors wired their 1890 brick addition to the home for electricity, even though it wasn't available yet. They had to wait 2 years before finally receiving it. And you thought waiting for the cable guy was too long. Today's cattle ranching has evolved with more scientific applications, which of course has its own risks and uncertainties. The Grants and Coors Ranch provides a reminder of an important chapter in the history of the West. In 1913, Conrad Coors wrote, "They were a rugged set of men, these pioneers, well qualified for their self-assumed task. In the pursuit of wealth, a few succeeded, and the majority failed. The range cattle industry has seen its inception, zenith, and partial extinction all within a half century. The changes of the past have been many. Those of the future may be of even more revolutionary character." Did you know that more than one quarter of all cowboys were African American? Cowboys also arrived from European countries and the East Coast. The Grant Coors Ranch National Historic Site offers a peek into the Old West, from sewing needles to wagons, linen maps to leather tack, over 35,000 artifacts from the 1860s to the 1960s. Now, this is what's really cool for me as a personal historian. The site's archive consists of over 100 shelf feet of records, ledgers, letters, and receipts covering the origin of the ranch's purchase through Coors' grandson's ownership to 1972. The ranch collections is the only cultural resource of its kind in the entire national park system. The collections are accessible by appointment for on-site research by contacting the site curator directly at 406-846-2070, extension 242. I have a book to share that you definitely need to get your hands on, 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas by Marie Helene Bertino. Generally, it focuses on the efforts of a seriously precocious 9-year-old who's lost her mother and her grief-stricken father who can't recover from his wife's loss. She loves to sing, but circumstances keep getting in the way. Her mother had been a singer, by the way. The story is told within a 24-hour period. Each chapter has a time of the day so you can track it. It not only follows her, but it follows the people that are in her life and those who cross her path. Now, this is the thing. It's the writing. There are descriptive personalities and great humor, but she keeps turning corners, but the author keeps turning corners on you and dropping things off at entrances you didn't know existed, let alone seeing coming. I am not a writer, so this is the best visual I can provide. Imagine you're holding a brownie. Suddenly, you're looking at a shell that was lodged in a corner of the brownie. Now you're looking at a chunk of double chocolate, now a piece of coconut, now the burnt bottom. When one character becomes embarrassed, she describes her cheeks as the color of ham. I know, you see it perfectly, don't you? After reading the first few paragraphs, it took my brain a few seconds to process that I was about to journey into a delectable literary dessert. Man, I love this book. Again, that's 2 a.m. at the Cat's Pajamas by Marie Helene Bertino. Do something different. Use the good dishes today. You are the special occasion.